Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, May 11th, 2026. Happy you are here to listen to us, and thank you for doing that. We got a good show for you here on the program this morning. We're going to start off with a discussion with a SFU researcher about deep fakes. AI is a big problem and all the things that go with it. Well, we'll get into that in a minute, but he's researching just how easy it is for folks from different demographics, etc., to be able to tell and with what confidence they can tell whether they're looking at a real image or a deepfake image. It is a big problem, particularly around scams, and we'll get into that a bit in that interview. We also have a report from Danny Nesvadarani from the recent Jane's Walk. It's a walk inspired by Jane Jacobs, who was a famous urbanist and wrote a really seminal book about 40 years ago opposing the great trend in urban renewal, which involved driving freeways through city centers and creating an entire separation between where people lived and where people worked and where people shopped, and a whole lot of other stuff. So and there's an annual walk about that, and Danny went to that to capture that. So we're going to hear from that. We have, of course, Gardening with Embark, and we also have a report, because it was Red Dress Day last week, and we have a report about that from our friends in Nanaimo. And Gardening with the Bark, I think I mentioned that already, and Peter will be here later at the end of the show for our little chat, and all that and more right here on Speak Up during this hour. My name is Magnus Tevels, and I'm happy to be your host for today, and I'm thankful that you are out there listening. Remember, anything you hear on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us a text to our text line, or you can give us a call, but you can do either, which is 778-782-2573 or 782-CJSF. Just send us a text if you hear something, if you got a question, you want to hear something, you got some feedback and commentary, we would love to hear from you. So give us a shout. All right, we're going to get into our first segment here. Emmett Robbins is a PhD student in the here at SFU in the Department of Criminology, and he's been looking into as part of his dissertation work, his studies. He's been looking into deepfakes and the influence of AI in that realm. If you don't know what a deepfake is, basically, it is where various sort of image AI tools, and it can also be done sort of hand done with tools like Photoshop, but AI makes it a whole lot easier these days. You can really just do it with a few prompts and get something you want, where you can create completely fake scenes, and often they involve either famous or public figures, or sometimes family members, with the goal of either doing a scam or creating misinformation to influence the political world. And they're getting better at a rapid rate, and it's really important to understand them better, both in terms of at the academic level where Emmett Robbins is at, but also, and I think this is part of what his research is about, at the everyday level, because any of us can be affected by this. I talked to Emmett last week, and here's our conversation. You're PhD here at SFU, and you're from the Department of Criminology. What's the focus of your studies or your PhD thesis dissertation?
So what I'm working on in my dissertation is studying basically how well people can tell deepfakes from real videos. As we know, in the past couple of years, deepfakes have gone from kind of ridiculous and uncanny sounding to being almost impossible to distinguish from real videos. And I wanted to produce some concrete data on exactly how effective people are at telling deepfakes apart.
So you're doing a you have a survey out there where you're getting people to sort of try their hand at figuring it out. We'll come back to that a little later. But first, what are deepfakes?
So deepfakes fall under the category of AI-generated content. These are videos that specifically deepfakes are videos that just depict people, mostly people talking. Whereas AI videos can be videos of animals, videos of people in crazy scenarios that are fictitious and imaginative. Deepfakes specifically are just somebody's face, shoulder up, talking.
Yeah. So why should we, I imagine there can be some beneficial uses, but why should we be concerned about deepfakes?
Well, because with deepfakes now you can really, really effectively replicate other people. So that means that celebrities are constantly getting replicated. People can sit down and create scripted videos of a celebrity speaking, and they can also use certain apps to basically wear the celebrity's face like a mask and make their voice sound like the celebrity, which means that they can have a live video call with somebody. And that's been a big issue in the past couple of years. There's been a lot of celebrity scams where people think that they're in a romantic relationship with Brad Pitt or Keanu Reeves and are sending thousands of dollars to a scammer. Other people think they're joining exclusive fan groups of a celebrity, and they're similarly sending thousands of dollars, thinking that they're talking to a celebrity.
And some of the software out there doesn't even need a lot of material to work from anymore. You can fake people's family members and stuff.
Yeah, that's true. So when I created the deepfakes that I used for my survey, all I needed was a 30-second recording of somebody speaking to be able to create a replication of their voice and then make audio files of them saying whatever I wanted them to say.
So who's using these deepfakes?
I mean, they're being used pretty widely. I mean, people are posting them on social media for fun without necessarily malicious intent. There's all types of political manipulation going on as well. I mean, there's whole YouTube channels, dozens and dozens of YouTube channels that are just constantly sharing fake news, deepfakes of Carney, deepfakes of other politicians. And this is happening all over the world, influencing what people think and understand about politics. And then scammers are using them to impersonate celebrities, to impersonate people's family members. There's been a lot of cases where somebody will get a call and it sounds like, somebody close to them, their child, their parent, and they're saying, "Hey, I'm being held hostage. You need to pay the ransom." So pretty scary stuff.
Yeah. So what happens in a world where images and video can no longer be trusted? I mean, this is sort of one of the things. It's like, if there's a picture or if there's video, it's like, okay, but that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's true. It's really eroding trust online. I mean, it used to be that, if you read a crazy headline on social media, you're skeptical, you wait and you can try and find a video to verify it. But now you can see a video and really have no reason to believe that it's a deepfake because it's so realistic. And yeah, I mean, you could be believing something totally fictitious. So trust on the internet is pretty much gone, at least for now. I think that there's going to be some changes in the next few years in terms of how identities are verified online. But, I can't read the tea leaves with how quickly everything's moving. But I think people are going to start to move away from social media as a reliable source of news.
So tell me about the survey you're running.
Right. Yeah. So I created a survey where people fill out a series of questions, background, demographic, perceptions, and knowledge of deepfakes, social media use. And then they complete a 10 item kind of test where they watch a video. It's about a 10 to 15 second video. They can rewatch it up to 3 times. And then they're asked whether it was real or a deepfake, how confident they are, how familiar they are with the people in the video. And all of the people shown in these videos are well-known celebrities. I have two politicians and then some actors and musicians who, you know, you probably know the names of 8 or 9 of the 10 of them. And yeah, I made them myself using these tools. I got to experience firsthand how lifelike you can make them, especially if you put in the effort.
Right. So what are you hoping to learn from the survey and your research?
Well, I mean, there's so much that could come out of the data that I'm collecting. I think one pretty salient one will be the effect of age on correct identification. From what I'm seeing, looking just at brief descriptives, younger people seem to be faring better. People between 18 and 25 seem to be faring better than the participants that I've had who are 50 plus. There's a mix across the board, but that's just one thing I've observed so far. I'm interested to see if people's confidence might, like how confident they are that they know what a deepfake is might impact that, because there's been plenty of research in within the cybercrime kind of worlds that show that people who are very confident in their IT skills, in their ability to recognize scams, they actually perform worse at recognizing scams than people who are a bit less confident.
It certainly is getting more and more difficult to spot these things. I've seen, you know, various photos or videos online where on a casual look, if you just sort of, it's coming across your feed or whatever, it looks pretty legit. And until you really start looking at details in different points and stuff, it's easy to be fooled.
It's really easy to be fooled. And I've been paying super close attention to deepfakes and kind of my algorithm's been a lot of them for a long time because I'm trying to keep up with this tech. And in like September, I was seeing how quickly, you know, it's like a month or two and you can see a substantial jump in quality. And I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, it's going to be less than a year before I'm going to see videos and I'm going to believe them even after like a double take. And that's really what sticks out to me, is that to identify a deepfake before, it just meant kind of looking somewhat closely at the video, watching their mouth as they're speaking. And it was pretty obvious just at that first look. And now I'm looking super closely and rewatching a few times, and sometimes I can't tell. And I read the comments, and the way that people have determined what a deepfake is so obscure. It's like based on the physics of what's going on in the video, these tiny granular details, things that you really aren't looking for people really aren't accustomed to looking for when they're seeing a video. So it's super, super hard to find those details.
It certainly seems like it's going to get scarier and scarier in that aspect. And, you know, in terms of, you know, you talked about the trust and stuff for the internet. You know, earlier this week we had that incident here in Vancouver where the whale got hit by the jet skier. And when I saw that video first come across my feed, my first thought was, because it looks so crazy, that particular video. And I realize it's a little different than the deepfakes you're talking about. But my first thought, and that's a real video, was that, oh man, that's fake, that somebody made some crazy video and posted it here. And then, of course, you learn some more stuff and that one was genuine. But, you know, it's one thing, you know, if we can't tell the difference between what's real and what's fake, it's not good.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. Look how much your assumption has changed. Up until a couple months ago, your assumption was that things were real until you found out that they were fake. But now your assumption is, you know, either unsure, or in a scenario where it seems like an unbelievable video, it's like, okay, this is fake until I'm proven otherwise. So like, just like that, you know, right before our eyes, the presumption has changed about what's real and what's fake online.
Yeah. How long is you're going to be having the survey open for?
I think it's going to be open another month. If you're an SFU student, you'll see some of my posters around campus if you want to take the survey.
Right. And are you open to participation from non-students and other members of the community?
I've opened it. I've gone around to some community centers, senior citizen, or retirement homes, and at immigrant outreach locations to distribute posters promoting the survey. And I've posted it I also posted the survey on Prolific, to where I got about 500 participants from all from Canadians, wide range of Canadians across the country.
Great. Well, this sounds really, really interesting. Your research, I'd love to have you back later after you've sort of closer to figuring out what you're going to find out and drawing some conclusions around it.
Sure. I'd love to share one tip for avoiding getting scammed by a deepfake before I head off. This is specifically focusing on phone calls because of the audio deepfakes. If you receive a call from somebody, whether it's a coworker or a family member, and it doesn't really seem to make sense, it seems like it could be a scam, it seems unbelievable, if you just stop to ask them a question that only they would know, something obscure, something unique, something that a scammer wouldn't be able to figure out, wait for them to provide an answer, like a kind of like a secret code word to verify that who you're talking to is who you think you're talking to. And that knowledge, that ability to get creative and ask questions like that is, you know, the best defense that we have against these people who are trying to scam us.
Yeah, that sounds like great advice, and always looking for more than one source for anything. If it seems crazy, maybe check to see if there's more than one source for where these things come from.
100%. Yeah, you got to be super careful and just be a bit of a online detective when it comes to verifying anything.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Emmett Robbins, of the PhD student with the Department of Criminology here at SFU. Thanks for joining us today, and we look forward to seeing more about your research.
Thank you so much, Magnus.
Thanks. And that was Emmett Robbins from SFU's Department of Criminology, and he is investigating deepfakes. He has a survey going on right now, as you heard about in the interview, and we're not going to give out the link for that just because... Well, you know, it's the modern internet, and what Emmett found was that from certain distros, certain promotions of his of the survey that he put out there, it attracted a lot of bot traffic. You know, it's more of that sort of, you know, that then he, you know, I mean, he had to go through and try and sift out that non-human illegitimate responses to his survey, because of course that's going to mess up his data that he's going to be working with to work on his research. So, but if you really are interested, you can, there are posters around here at SFU, and you can go to some area community centers, or you can just sort of Google for his name, Emmett Robbins, and look into it that way, and you should be Emmett Robbins Deep Freaks. If you're really motivated and want to participate, you can do that. We'll have Emmett back in the fall when his survey has concluded, and he's had a bit of time to work through some of the data and talk to him more about what he's finding. I also wanted to expand a little bit on that last point that he made about how to protect yourself. Because, you know, nowadays you really do need to be pretty careful. There's so many opportunities for people to try and scam you. And there's the ones he was talking about there where scammers either call you up using AI to fake the voice of a loved one and say that they're in great trouble and they need money right away. There are romance scams, and you see a lot of stuff about this on the internet where people either steal photos or use completely AI-generated photos and then meet people through dating apps, or even you probably experience this on some of your chat platforms where you just get this random message coming in from someone with a, you know, it's a, with an associated picture of some very attractive young person. And of course, what they want to do is they want to engage you in some chatter, and they can be pretty convincing. And at some point, they ask for money, or they want to get you into crypto, or they got some investment scheme, or, you know, You know, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. But I think particularly important to be keeping an eye on some of the older folks in your family or in your circle, because they're particularly targeted for some of these romance type scams. If you have a grandparent or who's suddenly got some online romance going on, try and talk to them. Anyway, that was a really interesting from Emmett Robbins. Like I say, we'll have him back in a little in a few months to talk more about his research and what he's found from his survey. Now we'll be back in a moment with our report from Danny Nesvadarani about the Jane's Walk, and they're particularly talking about transportation options for the North Shore. As you know, getting on and off the North Shore can sometimes be a giant hassle, and the solutions are not easy. So they're going to be talking about that as part of the Jane's Walk. But first, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. May is the prime month across much of North America to celebrate the return of migratory birds from the tropics. Orioles, tanagers, buntings, cuckoos, and many more wing northward. But of all those coming back, it's the warblers that many eagerly await. Like the ovenbird, whose song we're hearing now. The warblers stand out as our most fabulous array of avian jewels. Like true gems, most are miniatures, around 5 inches long. And of the more than 50 species that brighten our spring, many gleam like precious stones. These birds dazzle us, from the glinting ornaments of the golden-winged warbler to the sky blue of the cerulean warbler. Nesting from southern wetlands to Arctic willows, species of warblers fill many niches, from fly-catching from the tallest trees to dwelling on the ground. And some of the warblers' names are unforgettable. The painted redstart. The prothonotary warbler, perhaps the brightest gem of all. And the worm-eating warbler. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is brought to you by Wild Delight Bird Food, which aims to support wild bird populations with clean, nutritious ingredients.
Something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday. You heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On May 3rd, Movement YVR, a transit advocacy group in Metro Vancouver, hosted a Jane's Walk in the Burnaby Heights neighborhood next to the Iron Workers Bridge, titled The Solution to North Shore Traffic. Jane's Walk is an annual festival of free community-led walking conversations inspired by urban writer and activist Jane Jacobs, whose writings made significant impacts on sociology, economics, and urban planning. Traffic on the North Shore has been an ongoing point of discussion for decades, and the Iron Workers Bridge that connects the North Shore to the rest of Metro Vancouver is now considered as the most congested bridge in the region. Many solutions have been proposed, from building another bridge to the bus rapid transit expansion being planned for the North Shore to Burnaby. Movement YVR held this walk not to discuss these projects, but to talk about what can be done right now to address the area's traffic congestion. CJSF attended the walk and afterwards sat down for an interview with Dennis Agar, executive director of Movement, to learn more about why they held this walk and what they hoped to teach. Please take a listen.
there's always a lot of pressure and conversation around expanding highway capacity to the North Shore. It always comes up on talk radio and on Daily Hive and places like that. Like, we just need another bridge to the North Shore. And we have written op-eds and generally tried to inject some facts into that conversation, which is that if you allow more cars to get onto the North Shore, like, think about where they're going to go. Like, they have nowhere to go, right? Like, the streets on the North Shore are already full. Like, you could widen a bridge, but then you'd have to widen Marine, and you have to widen Lonsdale and widen Keith. And, like, that's never, ever, ever going to happen. You're not going to be able to tear down tens of thousands of homes to widen a highway, nor would you want to. So it just takes a, like, the walk that we held on the weekend was to show, okay, this is how you can actually move more people on and off the shore in a less congested way. There are ways to basically tweak the design of the existing roads and highways to put buses in front of other cars and have them go speedy. Even in, you know, even when there's a crash on the bridge, there are ways to keep the bus moving.
And the focus for this walk was particularly Second Narrows Ironworkers Bridge. Speak to me about that. One thing you mentioned that piqued my interest, because I had never considered it, was that the Ironworkers is at the end of its design life, I believe is what you said. If you could expand on that a bit.
You know, it was actually someone else on the tour who said that.
Okay.
But it's, I think that's becoming more widely known that, like, the TransLink is starting to think about replacing it. That's kind of what happened to the Patullo, right? Like, it was at the end of its design life, and now it's the Stalo Awesome Bridge. So we are going to have to have a conversation as a region about what to do with it. Of course, its life can be extended. Like, I've seen plenty of infrastructure go far beyond its design life. So it's not a hard and fast rule that, like, hey, we need to replace this bridge right away. There's still so many pieces that need to come together, like, basically funding, right? Like, you know, levels of government need to contribute funding to it. And then it's like, okay, what do we replace it with? Do we put rail on the bridge? Do we do all this stuff? And really my focus on the weekend was just about the stuff we can do before that happens. But I agree that definitely, like, we need to also think about what happens, you know, in the long term.
Is the BRT just the solution to this? Is that, I guess, the number one thing in your mind?
Okay, BRT is going to be awesome, but it can mean so many different things, right? Like, BRT can get watered down. It's at its root, what is BRT? It's just the idea of using buses to get as close to SkyTrain level of service as possible, like finding ways to make the bus fast, reliable, good stations, like basically all the things that SkyTrain has, but like simulated. You can do that through neighborhoods in the North Van and in Burnaby, where you have like the bus running down the middle of the street with stations. I don't know if we'll be able to do that on the bridge. It would be, I think, a pretty drastic step to put bus lanes along the entire bridge. I would love to see it. But the good news that I was trying to share in that talk is that we don't necessarily have to. For the most part, the bridge is actually uncongested on the deck itself. It's really, the challenge is really getting onto the bridge, all the queues on either side. And as if we can get the bus around those queues getting onto the bridge, then we can get those buses moving smoothly, faster than driving, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's an issue that I think on both major bridges that connect the North Shore to the rest of Metro Vancouver. You see in Lionsgate too, there is that bus priority lane, but there is a bottleneck that's kind of created before you get on the bridge. And
exactly,
that is what you're trying to address here, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's kind of a perfect setup for bus priority, right? Because you can, where you have room on land, you bottle up all those cars that are waiting to get on the bridge, and then you just have a bypass for the bus, like a queue jump lane where the bus can just get around the queue and then it merges back onto the bridge. That's exactly what we have on the Lionsgate. And we have it in one direction on the Second Narrows Bridge too, but we just need to finish the job by having it on all directions and designing it in a way that the bus can get around all of the queue, not just part of the queue.
Was there anything that, you know, there were a good amount of people in attendance for the talk and walk, and I'm wondering if there was anything that someone said that surprised you. You know, obviously this is something